This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Mark Rotenberg from the Electronic Privacy Information Center.
Winning victories, disclosing documents about cutting off our cell phones at demonstrations, or recently demonstrating a continuing investigation of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange by our wonderful Department of Justice.
Attorney Jules Lobel joins us again to talk about his lawsuit challenging long-term solitary confinement in California prisons.
80,000 people are in solitary confinement in this country. The worst of them are in Pelican Bay. We'll bring you an update on that amazing litigation that may put an end to solitary as we don't want to know it.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, the Sunni Muslims in Iraq were defeated during the course of the American war against Iraq, and now there's been a tremendous development in Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq. Tell us about it.
You know, as we've covered on this show many times, I mean, probably the most upsetting event of the last decade was the United States going to war in Iraq and overthrowing Saddam Hussein. Without discussing Saddam Hussein, good guy, bad guy, mixed guy, it was a completely illegal war, a war of aggression, killed perhaps a million people. And while the U.S. has supposedly pulled out, they've left complete chaos, and the war has created, you know, complete and utter chaos in Iraq. The place is clearly falling apart at this point, and the latest news is remarkable. The latest news is on the back of the Sunnis taking over Fallujah. And remember Fallujah, that was taken over about 6 months ago by the Sunnis, but particularly the group is called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, an organization that supposedly was once part of Al-Qaeda. And Fallujah is now under their control, under Sunni control, but it wasn't a major city. And it also, you have to recall, many Americans were killed in Fallujah. U.S. put in a huge amount of money and forces to try and take it back years ago. They did, and now it's gone again. But the big news today, which I think is actually shocking and just tells us we have a real problem in the Middle East right now, is now the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria has taken over the city of Mosul. They came in from Syria. And remember, these are people who want to put together caliphate made up at this point of Syria and Iraq, or at least parts of those two countries. They came over and they have taken over the city of Mosul, which is the second biggest city in Iraq, 1.4 million people. And the Iraqi forces, mostly Shiite, who were, you know, supporting the government, have fled the city. And so now you're seeing a situation where Iraq, it not only has the Kurdish part in the north, which is practically a separate state or is a separate state, now you have the Sunnis taking over Mosul and Fallujah. And the question is, what's going to happen now? But I can tell you now, you got chaos. And so when all of you out there think about getting a woman president and Hillary Clinton, just think this. This is the person who voted for the Iraq war and for what we're seeing in front of us. And this is the person who did it not because she believed in it, but because of political expediency. Her expediency has cost million lives and caused the situation today, along with many others who voted for this, the media who went for it, from the New York Times to the Washington Post, etc. This is what the United States has wrought in Iraq.
Heidi, a potentially game-changing ruling has come down in Los Angeles with respect to teacher security and education and the privatizing of education in the United States. What's your take on it?
Basically, what happened, Michael, is that last week a judge ruled that tenure laws have deprived students of their right to an education under the California State Constitution and has violated their civil rights. This sends a blow to teachers' unions and could radically alter how California teachers are hired and fired, and I think will prompt challenges to tenure laws in other states.
Well, that's what the right wing is predicting, that this is going to put some wind in their sails. The judge, who was a Republican appointee, ironically cited Brown versus the Board of Education and its equal protection argument, and said that these poor children are not receiving equal protection because they've got teachers there that are tenured and therefore can't be fired. And the reason, and this is key, the reason these people say that kids are getting a bad education is that they have bad teachers. Well, we all know that there's a lot of reasons why these kids don't make it, starting with the fact, say, that they don't get breakfast in the morning. So what are we talking about here? They want to dismantle the trade unions that the teachers have built and substitute private commodity schools for public education.
We're going to have a longer report on this case on Law and Disorder because it's really critical. And as Michael Smith said, it's about privatizing school. It's about the struggle for public education. It's about unions and destroying unions. And we've seen this going on for a long time. If anybody saw the movie Waiting for Superman, that is also about charter schools, getting rid of unions, and really getting rid of public education. So this is very serious what's happening in California. And let's also see where it comes from. It's a millionaire Silicon Valley person, financed it for over a number of years, set up the organization that ultimately litigated it, brought in certain kinds of plaintiffs who happened to be poor and felt that they weren't getting in, probably were not getting a good education, and then hired the best lawyers he could find for this kind of case.
Ted Olson, the Solicitor General under Bush.
Former Solicitor General
Ted Olson. So these children are in effect being used as pawns.
Precisely. The case is called Vergara versus the State of California and the California Teachers Union. Stay tuned.
I want to be careful about the word pawns, Heidi, because you know, it is true that in this country, poor children, black children, Latino children, do not get a very good education. And they're struggling with how do they deal with it. And you know, people put forth, well, you can't fire your bad teachers. You know, we'll get a set up a charter school. We'll do this. We'll do that. And so it's pawns is a way to say it. But in fact, there's a real issue here of how do we educate our population. And the neoliberal model, which is what's really going on here, we're having our country and Arne Duncan, as Michael Smith said, the commissioner of education, support this kind of getting rid of tenure, getting rid of unions, privatizing the schools, rather than putting massive more amounts of money into the schools, improving the schools.
Paying teachers more.
Paying teachers what they deserve for teaching, et cetera.
Right.
They're doing it this way. And it's all part and parcel of the America that is today, of neoliberal America.
Right.
Michael, so I understand we finally won the trifecta.
Well, yes. Heidi and you before her made presentations about your books at the New York Public Library. And this is an invitation for all you listeners out there, because on Monday, June 23rd at 6:30 at the Mid-Manhattan Library on 5th Avenue and 40th Street, that's 455 5th Avenue, southeast corner of 5th Avenue and 40th Street, I'm going to be speaking about the book I co-edited, Living in a Socialist USA. Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And I'm going to be speaking with my two co-editors, Debbie Smith, Francis Golden, Cliff Connor, who wrote the chapter on how to get from where we are to where we want to be, and Fred Jerome, who wrote the chapter on media. So we ask all of you to consider coming down on Monday, June 23rd, the Mid-Manhattan Library. It's on the southeast corner of 40th and 5th Avenue, not the one with the Lions, the one kitty corner from the Lions. It's up on the sixth floor. We got a big room, a microphone, and a stage, and the New York Public Library has given us a platform to talk about, imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. They put out a leaflet. Listen to this, Michael. They put out a leaflet that says, pulling the curtain back on the true meaning of socialism.
I'm amazed, actually. I mean, this is the major institution, or one of the major institutions in New York City. It is a public institution, which is the public library, but it's remarkable they're doing this book. So it's great, Michael. I think everybody who listens to this should get there. It's an amazing forum. Congratulations.
Thanks. The book is divided into three sections. The easiest section to write was an indictment of capitalism. All you have to do is really listen to this radio show or WBAI every day. The major part of the book is how every institution in this country would be different if we got rid of the capitalist system, if we got rid of making commodities for profit. And then the third part of the book is how to get from where we are to where we want to be. That's what we're going to be talking about on June 23rd. Mid-Manhattan Public Library, 40th and 5th Avenue, 636th floor. Be there.
The Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, is among a handful of organizations trying to reveal the massive surveillance of the National Security Agency. Today we talk about a few of EPIC's most important cases. Recently, they filed a massive FOIA request to the Criminal and National Security Divisions of the Department of Justice, asking for records on individuals who were targeted for surveillance because of their support or visiting websites of WikiLeaks. We'll also talk about their important victory against the Department of Homeland Security and its ability and use of deactivating wireless communications in a crisis, or rather, in political demonstrations. Mark Rotenberg, Executive Director of EPIC, joins us to talk about these ongoing cases.
Welcome, Mark, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
You've got three interrogators here.
Three interrogators.
Excellent. Did you see the big news from us last week on Friday? We got NSPD 54. That was our case in the D.C. Circuit against the NSA.
So go ahead. Keep talking about the big news.
The Freedom of Information Act request we had made 5 years ago for the NSA Cybersecurity Authority. It was a request that we sent to the NSA and litigated in the district court, and were on appeal to the D.C. Circuit last Friday, just a few days before the government's brief was due. They contacted us and said that they were disclosing to us the document that we had been trying to obtain. This is National Security Presidential Directive 54, and it outlines all the cybersecurity authorities for the federal agencies. There was not exactly a declassified version released earlier, although the administration calls it that. It was actually a paraphrased version in the form of a white paper. But we, through this FOIA lawsuit, EPIC versus NSA, actually got the underlying document disclosed. So we're pretty happy about that.
Congratulations.
Well, your work has been great.
We actually wanted to start, Mark, with a short overview of the scope of EPIC's work, because you do so much in terms of privacy advocacy, technology, amicus briefs. And I think you have two of the most popular privacy websites in the world.
Yes, EPIC.org and privacy.org.
What, aside from what you've just described, would you sort of summarize as being the scope of your work?
Well, the scope of our work is very much driven by our mission, and our mission is to focus public attention on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. We're not really a lobbying group. We used to call ourselves an ACLU for the 21st century, but of course the 21st century came along, so that no longer works. But our thinking is, how do we take our civil liberties interests and beliefs and values and understand the many new challenges that are arising both from government practices and from business practices. Just to use a few examples, you know, the FBI wants to put together a next generation identification system, which will be the largest biometric database in the world, and we think the implications for privacy and freedom are just staggering. But you know, Google, of course, which most people are very happy about, also retains everybody's search histories and uses this extremely intimate information about what people are interested in, what they're concerned about, what their beliefs are, and saves it and commercializes it. And we think those issues also need to be examined and understood. We use a wide range of activities and strategies. I think it is primarily our websites, because we're most interested in just trying to inform people so that they can make their decisions. But we also do a lot of open government litigation so that people can learn more about these issues. And we do a lot of amicus briefs So when folks are bringing cases in federal and state court that raise novel civil liberties and privacy issues, we will oftentimes write an amicus brief with a group of experts trying to bring some new information to the court's attention, not simply to say, well, we think privacy is important, but actually, if you're talking about the accuracy, for example, of computerized criminal record systems, which is a big problem right now in the United States, we said to the court in Herring a few years back, you just can't allow police to rely on inaccurate criminal records because it'll create no incentives to maintain accuracy.
Mark, I guess you know that I'm one of the lawyers for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And
of course,
I follow your work really closely because you've done remarkable and amazing work on the FOIA, Freedom of Information Act work, with regard to WikiLeaks, but really in a clever way, asking about whether there's been surveillance of WikiLeaks supporters or people who've gone to their website. Can you just talk about that case, how long it's been going on and where you are, and then we'll
sure.
get to the...
That was an interesting case for us, and you know, in our organization, there actually is a deep division about WikiLeaks. You know, some people think Julian Assange is a hero, and some people, you know, would like to see him arrested. We had a similar debate recently over Edward Snowden. We decided to give him an award, but a lot of people in the organization were upset about that, and some people actually left. And we respect those divisions. Now, what was interesting to us about the WikiLeaks case is because I think we had been approached to work on the defense team, and we decided that really wasn't an appropriate role. But we did see a person's expression of support for WikiLeaks as core First Amendment speech. I mean, what could be more vital than the ability of a person to, you know, express interest with a viewpoint, and particularly with regard to WikiLeaks itself, which we see as a media organization and entitled itself to strong First Amendment protections. So we became very interested through the Freedom of Information Act and how the federal government apparently was intervening with private companies, bank payment companies, cloud service providers, and others to try to chill the ability of WikiLeaks supporters to contribute to the organization, to get access to hosted documents. And again, it wasn't because we necessarily believed with the viewpoints of the WikiLeaks supporters. It was because we simply believed that it was wrong for the government to discourage people from expressing their support or even their opposition to what WikiLeaks was doing.
What were the results that you've gotten so far? What was the government's reaction? I know the case has been going on for a couple of years, I think.
Yeah, I don't think we've received very much so far. I mean, the most recent batch of documents did indicate that the government's investigation of Assange is ongoing because this was the basis, I think, for the assertion of the 7C exemption of the FOIA, which you could really only do in the instance, or I'm sorry, I think it's 7A, in fact, which you could really only do in the instance of an ongoing investigation. So as we've gone back and forth in that case, and it's largely about the validity of the assertions that the agency is making, I think most recently it was the fact that the agency continued to assert 7A that was significant. I would have to go back and look a little bit more closely, but that's my recollection.
Yeah, that was, for my work, was really critical. What happened is you appealed on the grounds that, well, Chelsea Manning has been convicted, sentenced in 35 years. How can the government continue its use of continuing investigation of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange for denying you documents? And you forced, essentially, the government to put in an affidavit that said the investigation is continuing in both the National Security Division and in the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice. And for looking at Julian Assange and asylum and, you know, what's going on in the United States, that's the most current statement, a few weeks ago, as I recall, that we have that says there's a continuing investigation of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. So it turned out from my perspective to be a really important piece of litigation, something that the government has really never been willing to put on paper for us in the most direct way they did in your case.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. I mean, I think I was aware, certainly from some of the news reporting, that people had picked up on that affidavit and that it did receive some attention. You know, the interesting thing is, I'm sure you know, Michael, with the Freedom of Information Act, you know, one of the things you're trying to do is just get information out to the public and hope that others find that it's useful. and we've done a lot of this over the years. Even when we got NSPD 54 on Friday, we were thinking to ourselves that, you know, we thought we understood the significance, but then, of course, we realized that there were others with more expertise and maybe themselves involved in related litigation that would find things that we couldn't find. So one of the, you know, various parts of EPIC's history, which I'm proud of, is I think we were actually the first organization that took documents that we had obtained through a Freedom of Information Act case, and this goes back to 1994, and scanned them and made them available on the web so that people could download them and view them. Now I know, you know, pretty much everyone does that nowadays, but, you know, 20 years ago, the web interface had just been developed, and it really was the moment at which it became possible to easily, you know, view images online and download the documents. And we were very purposeful about it. We thought it was very important that whatever we were getting, others should have access to.
Mark, earlier you alluded to the role that big business plays in the surveillance state. What are your thoughts about Microsoft's challenge to prosecutors who were trying to force him to hand over customers' email that's stored in a data center in Ireland? Do you think that signals a trend of corporations saying, enough, we don't want to cooperate? Or is it just a public relations maneuver?
I was glad to see that. You know, and some of the other companies as well are starting to stand up for the users, which I think is very important. One of the key points that we often make in the privacy realm is that these companies, by becoming service providers and collecting data about users or providing an email service or a social network service or whatever it may be, actually have an obligation to the users to protect their privacy interests. And it flows directly from the nature of the businesses that they're establishing. So we think it is a fundamental obligation for any internet company that collects personal data to stand up to the government when there are court orders, and of course when there are requests maybe not even involving court orders, which is one of the great areas of concern post 9/11, national security letters and you know, bulk surveillance and the other techniques that the Department of Justice has used. Now, to be clear, you know, we recognize that in some circumstances, the law, you know, law enforcement agencies do have a right to get access to evidence, but we think it has to be pursuant to a public legal standard, not a secret standard or secret interpretation, and there has to be an independent determination. I mean, I know this is, you know, maybe Fourth Amendment 101, but I think helping people to understand just how critical those principles are also makes clear why so much of the government's activity over the last several years has really gone off the rails. And, you know, I'm glad to see that the companies are beginning to push back. At the same time, you know, I'd also say for many years we were saying to these same companies, if you didn't retain so much data on your users, you would simply be less attractive as targets for those kinds of phishing expeditions. And so I think they do bear some responsibility. For example, you know, not encrypting traffic routinely, not only the email traffic, but the backbone traffic. You know, companies said, well, that's too expensive and it's too cumbersome. Well, their failure to do that has left a lot of private communications, you know, exposed to law enforcement interception.
Speaking of educating the public, one development that I think is positive, a victory related to the Department of Homeland Security not being able to use a so-called kill switch. Can you explain what that is?
Well, that's another case. I mean, it's not like, you know, everything works out well here, but we have had a little bit of success recently, and that was our other case before the D.C. Circuit that we'd actually won in the lower court, and now it's the Department of Homeland Security that's appealing. And this concerns a technique that was used in San Francisco basically to shut down cell phone service among people who had gathered at a protest to object to the police conduct, I think resulted in the death of a person on the BART system. And they were gathering at a BART station in San Francisco, and pursuant to a secret policy known as Standard Operating Protocol 303, somehow the DHS got the local telephone service to shut down cell phone service in the region, and people couldn't communicate, and the protest was effectively stopped. And, you know, I read about that, and I thought it was outrageous. I thought it was particularly outrageous because I was aware that the U.S. was simultaneously criticizing the Egyptian government for cutting off internet service.
That's right. That's great.
You know, and they're saying, you know, this is outrageous what the Egyptian government is doing. And I was actually involved in that debate because I also thought it was outrageous what the Egyptian government was doing. And we were working with NGOs in Egypt and elsewhere to try to make sure that they were maintaining their communications service. And then to learn simultaneously that the U.S. had deployed a similar technique to stop a protest in San Francisco just seemed very wrong. So our FOIA request was actually for the policy, which we think has to be made public. I mean, you can't, you just can't have a secret procedure that so deeply implicates First Amendment freedoms. And we went laser-focused after that one document. And the Department of Homeland Security was, you know, throwing up all these law enforcement exemptions. I think there was 7E and 7F involving techniques and methods and saying, you know, this is vitally important to protect public safety, which was an interesting argument, too, because they had all sorts of, you know, scenarios involving terrorists why they might want to be able to use this technique. But, of course, one of the things that people learned from 9/11 is that you actually need cell phone service to respond, you know, to a public safety disaster, so people can communicate. And it is a very dangerous decision on the part of the government to take away from people the ability to communicate in the case that there's an emergency. And I think that was actually Judge Boasberg in that case. I mean, the doctor in the case, of course, a little bit more narrow, but you know, essentially agreed with us that was not an appropriate set of circumstances to assert the FOIA exemptions. And so he basically ruled in our favor, said that the document should be disclosed to EPIC, and stayed his opinion, knowing that the agency was likely to appeal pending the decision now in the D.C. Circuit. So we're on appeal to the D.C. Circuit to see what's going to happen. I think it's just vitally important that policy be made public.
It can't be stopped unless it is made public. And right now it still exists.
Well, that's right. And it also can't be assessed. I mean, one of the other things we've learned over the years is that, you know, these are not just the concerns of, you know, civil liberties groups, let's say. I mean, I think these are really practical concerns that a lot of people would share if, you know, they had the time to kind of think through this. And if you say to most people, you know, and again, they don't have to be civil liberties folks. You just say, how do you feel about your government having the ability to shut down, you know, cell phone service, even in an emergency? And people say, wow, well, when would they do that? I mean, what kind of circumstances would justify that? And, you know, we would say, that's a really good question. The problem is we can't answer that because they're going to keep it secret. So, you know, that's not unlike another case we had a few years ago against DHS involving their monitoring of social media, like Twitter feeds and online news organizations. DHS had a handbook with key words in it. You know, cloud was one of the key words, I think. They're supposed to monitor all communications where the word cloud appears, which now apparently would sort of rope in just about every major internet company in America, but that's okay. I guess that would give them something to do. But we found this, and we said, you know, you can't be monitoring communications in this way, creating records on people without some actual, you know, predicate to justify all that. And when we obtained the documents and the keyword list, Congress held a hearing and told the agency to stop doing it.
Yeah, no, I think, this is Michael Ratner, I've been following the work of EPIC for many years. I just think it's fantastic. I mean, it's just really amazing what you guys have been able to do. But the question I have is, let's say I'm just some person listening to this radio show and I want to do a FOIA request. Where do I send them to? I know I don't send them to you, but there's sites that you can go to where you can begin to fill material out, or what?
Actually, there are a lot of organizations, including the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and others, that have created FOIA toolkits that help people who want to submit FOIA requests do it. It's not easy. I mean, I think people need to understand a typical FOIA request can take, you know, months, sometimes even years before it's adequately processed, and it can be frustrating. But it is an important right that everybody has. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter the reason for your request. It really doesn't matter what you're interested in finding out. The presumption in the Freedom of Information Act is that the records maintained by the federal government are presumptively public records, and people should have the right to get access to them. And if the government agency has a reason to withhold a record, the burden is really on the agency to justify the reason for the withholding.
Michael Ratner had a success with a FOIA request, Mark. He asked various government agencies, including the FBI and the CIA, about their involvement in the assassination of Che Guevara. And years later, he got two huge boxes of papers, which he and I went through and edited and published two books on it, showing that the CIA was responsible for killing Che Guevara. So these things are important in our practical experience.
The key is to file them before you're 80 years old, because ours took 10 years.
Yeah, you need a long lead time, no doubt about it.
Well, Mark, we could literally go on for hours, but I know you have other commitments, so we'd like to thank you so much for the important work that you do on behalf of EPIC.
And I just want to remind people that the epic.org or privacy.org is where you should go to.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you. It was really nice speaking with you. Maybe we can do this again sometime soon.
We'd love to. Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. For archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last year, we spoke with attorney Jules Lobel about the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit challenging long-term solitary confinement in California prisons. Recently, a federal judge in Oakland ruled to agree to consider as part of that lawsuit whether long-term isolation violates an inmate's Eighth Amendment rights. Prisoners in prolonged solitary confinement at Pelican Bay Prison can spend 22 to 24 hours daily in a cramped, concrete windowless cell with no contact with the outside world. Mostly, they're there for alleged connections to gangs and for their refusal to become government informants.
Jules, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be on with you folks.
Jules, I know you've done a lot with prisons in your life, litigating, etc. I don't think you've been in one for very long, but anyway, I mean, as a prisoner. But the latest case...
3 days in Washington, D.C. in 1970.
Yeah, did it good inform you?
Anti-war protest?
Anti-war protest.
May Day?
May Day, exactly.
Yeah. Did you ever get paid for it?
No, but I got a judgment that I was that my arrest was unlawful.
Well, congratulations. Well, but you've been interested in, I know, litigating very hard, tough cases in this society for a long time on prisons. You argued one in the Supreme Court that you won, etc. But the latest one you've been working on is huge and concerns solitary confinement and particularly Pelican Bay. Can you just give us a description of overall and that recent victory you've had? But start overall. What is Pelican Bay? Where is it? It concerns solitary. What's the solitary like?
Pelican Bay is a prison which holds over 1,000 prisoners. It's located in one of the most isolated sections of the United States on the coastline border between California and Oregon. It was deliberately placed there because most of the prisoners are from Los Angeles. It's very, very hard for their families and friends to visit them. So not only are they isolated in that they're in solitary, they spend virtually their whole day in an 80-square-foot cell with no window, but they get virtually no visitors, and they can't make any phone calls. They're fairly isolated from the outside world and from each other.
How long would somebody be placed in this kind of cell, and how do you get out?
Many of my clients have been in these cell for over a decade. As of right now, California estimates that there are about 225 prisoners who've been there for over a decade. A number of my clients have been there for over two decades. And the reason that they're there that long is because California puts them there, not because they've done anything violent in prison, or in some cases they've never done anything violent even outside of prison. Many of them are in there for the three strikes and you're outlawed, namely drug offenses and things like that. But because they have an association, could be very loose, could be simply having a tattoo or having a piece of artwork which suggests that you're in some way associated with a gang. And California takes the view that I first encountered when I saw West Side Story as a kid, that when you're a gang member, there's no way out. You're always a gang member from your first day in life to your last dying day. And therefore, they won't let these people out until recently. The only way out was to become an informant. And then, of course, you and your family were in grave danger of being killed or assaulted by the gang. And also many people in prison don't want to become informants. They just object to that as their only way out. So they languish in this prison for decades without ever having any way out. Recently, California, because of three hunger strikes, pressure from our lawsuit, pressure from the legislature, has instituted some reforms. So there are, for some of the people, a way out, at least to another solitary prison, or even in some cases to the general population. But our view of those reforms is that they don't really change the situation. They're just an attempt to react to the pressure upon them by the courts and the legislature.
Jules, I recall reading about one inmate who spent over 13 years in a so-called security unit at Pelican Bay, who was, quote, revalidated as a member of the Mexican Mafia because he possessed Aztec artwork. And my question is, how frequently do inmates thus categorized come up for review?
They come up for review once every 6 years under the system that's currently in place. And so you don't get even a review for 6 years. And then you could be revalidated or re-upped, so to speak, into this place for artwork, for sending a birthday card to another gang, alleged gang member, for talking to another alleged gang member. One incident has been in the past enough. As I said, they're trying to change the system. They've made reforms so that in the future, they say it'll be every 4 years, not every 6 years. But that's still unconstitutionally too long. I mean, the Ninth Circuit has said anything over a year is too long for reviews.
Jules, you recently won a huge victory in your litigation out there. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, the court just decided to certify a class. And that is a very important victory in the sense that there have been hundreds of lawsuits challenging various aspects of this situation in Pelican Bay, from the due process that they're not given any real chance to prove that they can get out, to the fact that it's cruel and unusual punishment to keep people in there for 10, 15, 20 years. But they've only been individual cases. And in some cases, the prisoners have won. In most of the cases, they're not represented by lawyers and they lose. But nothing changes. Nothing has changed. Now, for the first time, a judge has said, I'm going to take this as a class action, which means that I'm going to look at the general policies that California is instituting, and if we were to win, try to change the system as opposed to simply changing an individual situation. The other thing about granting class certification is that the judge rejected the arguments that the defendants are most likely to use at trial, which is that each individual's case is different, and therefore you can't really look at this as a broad policy issue because some people react in worse ways, some people react in better ways to this. Our argument is it doesn't matter how the person particularly reacts. these kind of conditions are cruel and unusual to keep people in for this long a time. So it's an important victory in moving this case forward.
Jules, there's a couple of details, if you want to call them that, that I've always found very striking about this case. One of them is how your client meetings go forward when you're visiting Pelican Bay. You describe the room, how you meet with your, 10 clients or so?
Yeah. Well, generally, lawyers can't meet with more than one client. Generally, when we visit, and when lawyers visit Pelican Bay, they meet with a client separated by a glass window, and you can actually only talk to your client by phone. There's a phone in their booth, and there's a phone in your booth, and it's as if you're in adjoining telephone booths talking to a client. It's a very horrendous way to actually meet with people. But we said that in order for us to come up with some proposal for a settlement, and for quite some time we were in settlement discussions with the state, which the state eventually broke off because they said they don't want to settle this case. But in order to meet with our clients, we said we have to meet with all 10 of them together. We can't meet with just one individual and then another individual. And the state said that's impossible. These folks are so dangerous, you can't possibly meet with them together. But the judge ordered it. And we got a meeting where, if you can imagine the cell that that Hannibal Lecter was kept in Silence of the Lambs.
The cage.
The cage, yeah, not a cell. It was that cage. They put 10 of these cages side by side.
Oh, my God.
And they kept all these people in shackles in these cages.
They put them in a room you were in, right?
And we were in a room. It was a big conference room with 10 cages put in. Each one of them was in a cage. They mandated that we had to wear flak jackets. We looked like Marines.
What?
Even though the cages have no way to get out. You know, I mean, how they would have hurt us, it's unclear. It's totally ridiculous. But it was to create, I think, the symbolism that these guys are so dangerous. In any event, we met for 3 hours with them. Remarkably, given the conditions that these folks face, they were able to carry on a very intelligent conversation in which they came up with all sorts of interesting suggestions as to how to change this situation and what you could do.
No, I always found that picture that you paint of that remarkable. If I were to do a sketch of this case, that would certainly be one of them.
We were seated at a table with these Marine outfits, these flak jackets, and they had these 10 cages, each of them in an individual cage, lined up in front of us.
But right? There's another detail that I think that I recall, I don't know if you can talk about it or not, about, let's say you're one of the parents of the people inside is dying. Tell me about the communications that you can make.
Yeah, you're not allowed a phone. They're not allowed any phone calls.
Period, while they're in solitary.
Period, no phone calls. No phone calls.
20 years, they can't call
20
you.
Years without a phone call. No contact visits, you know, no phone calls under the theory they want to totally isolate these people. Not even in the strictest of federal prisons, the federal supermax, are you not allowed phone calls. This is one of the only prisons in the country where you're not allowed phone calls. In any event, they make an exception. The exception is that if one of your parents dies, you could then call the surviving parent to get the news and to be consoled. You know, you get a half-hour phone call.
But you can't call your parent while they're dying.
No, you can't call the parent
goodbye.
While you're dying. That's not permitted. Only
Stunning.
After they die. We actually engage in a huge struggle where we were able recently to win that for one of the guys, that he could call his parent while she was dying. But it took a huge fight. That's not what the regulations say.
Then after he got to talk to his mother while she was dying,
yeah,
right?
Well,
but afterwards, what happened? When she died, could he call anybody else in the family like he normally could?
No, he used up his one phone call to talk to his mother. It gets more bizarre in that one of the guys had a father and a stepfather, and the father died, and then 2 years later, the stepfather died, and he was close to his stepfather, so he wanted to get a call to talk about it. But they said, no, you used up your one father figure.
No.
You know, it's gratuitously cruel.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think these stories highlight the cruelty of the whole system.
Mm.
You know, there's no preventive rationale.
Right.
The rationale for this whole thing mm-hmm. is that we're preventing these guys from committing, you know, riots or violence or mayhem in the regular prison. There's no preventive rationale for not letting a guy get a phone call to his stepfather or to talk to his sister after his mother dies. It's all and what it really is to force these guys to become informants. It's they're making it as cruel as possible, and they're also saying the only real way out is to become an informant, to force them to become informants. That's what's really going on.
Your lawsuit was premised on the Eighth Amendment to prevent cruel and unusual punishment. What does all these years in solitary do to the human personality?
Yeah, you know, for some people, it drives them crazy. For other people, they have an incredible ability to adapt, and they're able to adapt and not go crazy. So our 10 named plaintiffs are not mentally ill. They haven't been driven crazy by this, even though they've spent over a decade in solitary. But what it does is it profoundly alters your personality. You die what is essentially a social death. You become less interested or virtually uninterested in social relations and what makes us human. You know, there have been a lot of scientific studies of in the last 10, 20 years that part of the basic human personality is social relationships, and that's a basic human need in the same way as sleeping, eating, and exercises. And what these people really are deprived of is that ability to have social relationships. And even if they can survive this torture by adapting to it, they lose that ability to maintain social relationships. You know, I have one of my clients who told me after 12 years he actually got out of prison, but he had spent 12 years in solitary. And when he got home to his family, he had to eat his meals in his bedroom. He couldn't eat his meals with the rest of the family because he was so used to just being alone that it was too frightening for him to eat his meals with the rest of the family. And that's what it does to people, even if it doesn't drive them crazy.
Jules, we want to hear a little bit about the lawsuit and timing, but before that, I just sort of had a hypothetical. What if several of these individuals agreed to become informants and then when they got out, spoke to the news media about all of this? Is that something that could help raise awareness?
Well, it would be a long haul
right.
for them to do that, many of my clients wouldn't want to do that even if they could later speak to the news media. But we do have quite a number of people who have gotten out who are speaking to the news media, both in this case and in other cases. For example, one of the Angola Three, Robert King, is lecturing around the country and wrote a book, and I spoke on a panel with him in Chicago about his experiences and the way it's affected him. So there's mounting evidence and mounting stories by people who have gotten out as to the disastrous effects that this has on the human personality. Our case, really, if we were to win, would, I think, be the beginning of the death knell for solitary confinement in this country. 80,000 prisoners in this country, as we speak, are in some form of solitary. This is probably one of the more draconian forms that we're challenging. But it's come under increasing attack, both in the international human rights community, within the country, and I think its day has hopefully come and gone. You know, in the 19th century, America tried an experiment with solitary confinement, and it was an utter failure. And we gave it up for about 100 years, only to reinvent it as part of the mass incarceration of the 1980s. And I think it's on its way out. And this case, hopefully, will help speed the time when we don't use solitary in this country.
Now, Jules, that 80,000 figure is both federal and state, is that right?
Federal and state prisons.
Okay, yes. One question I have for you is related to the United States and, let's say, Western Europe. How do the figures of 80,000 solitary here compare to countries in Western Europe, the EU, et cetera?
Totally out of whack. You know, I mean, we put thousands and thousands of more people in solitary than any other country in the world. You know, in Britain, there are a handful of people in solitary, and they don't have the same kind of conditions as exist in Pelican Bay. Throughout Europe, in most countries, there might be a handful of the Carlos the Jackal in France, who was, you know, the number one wanted prison, alleged terrorist in the world, is, I think, in solitary.
So it would be fair to say there's probably under 100 or within that range in all of Europe.
If you took most countries in Europe, that would be the case. Yeah, there might be a few outliers even in Europe, but nothing like what we have. I mean, there might be more than 100, but nothing like what we have.
Jules, what's the next step, and what can people do to stay in touch with this process, and how can we help? But tell us about what you want to do next.
Our next step is to vigorously move forward in proving our case. We have psychological experts. We are trying to get a lot of the facts about how they operate this prison, what happens to people in prison, the psychological problems they have, and the physical problems. We believe that this causes not just psychological problems, but medical problems. And so a trial has been scheduled for a little over a year from now. Our task for the next 6 months is to get the facts to prove our case. What people can do to help is really stay in touch with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and of which I am president. One of the things about litigating this case is that it requires substantial funding, and the center is always looking for people to contribute to help with funding the case. We often put out advisories to write to Governor Brown on particular issues. There's all sorts of political organizing around this case. Don't forget that just last summer, around this time, we're approaching the one-year anniversary, 30,000 California prisoners went on hunger strike protesting solitary confinement. There's a continual political activity which people can plug into through the Center for Constitutional Rights.
What's the CCR's website, Jules?
CCRjustice.org, right? Okay.
That's it. CCRjustice.org. Go there. There's lots going on, obviously, everything from Pelican Bay to Guantanamo to Vatican sexual abuse scandals, et cetera. It's a great website, lots of information. And Jules' case, of course, I think is really one of the highlights.
Well, thank you, folks, for having me on.
Well, Jules, I want to say on behalf of all of us that you are truly a lawyer you'll like. Thank you for being on.
Thanks, Jules.
Thanks a lot, and thanks for doing this program. It's a great program.
Take care.
Take it easy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org and look for us on Facebook at Law and Disorder. Thank you.
Thank you.